Chapter 27. And it concluded that she perhaps suspected him of being an obstacle to her son's aspirations. He had no idea of playing that part, but was not sorry to appear to, for he was sincerely attached to Coral Hicks, and hoped for her a more human fate than that of becoming Prince Anastasius's consort. This evening, however, he was struck by the beaming alacrity of the aide-de-camp's greeting. Whatever cloud had hung between them had lifted. The Teutoburg clan, for one reason or another, no longer feared or distrusted him. The change was conveyed in a mere hand pressure, a brief exchange of words, for the aide-de-camp was hastening after a well-known dowager of the old Roman world, whom he helped into a large coroneted brougham which looked as if it had been extracted, for some ceremonial purpose, from a museum of historic vehicles. And in an instant it flashed on Lansing that this lady had been the person chosen to lay the prince's offer at Miss Hicks' feet. The discovery piqued him, and instead of making straight for his own room he went up to Mrs. Hicks' drawing room. The room was empty, but traces of elaborate tea pervaded it, and an immense bouquet of stiff roses lay on the center table. As he turned away, Eldorada Tooker, flushed and tear-stained, abruptly entered. "Oh, Mr. Lansing, we were looking everywhere for you."
"Looking for me?"
"Yes. Coral especially. She wants to see you. She wants you to come to her own sitting room." She led him across the antechamber and down the passage to the separate suite which Miss Hicks inhabited. On the threshold, Eldorada gasped out emotionally, "You'll find her looking lovely," and jerked away with a sob as he entered. Coral Hicks was never lovely, but she certainly looked unusually handsome. Perhaps it was the long dress of black velvet which, outlined against a shaded lamp, made her strong build seem slenderer, or perhaps the slight flush on her dusky cheek. A bloom of womanhood hung upon her which she made no effort to dissemble. Indeed, it was one of her originalities that she always gravely and courageously revealed the utmost of whatever mood possessed her. "How splendid you look," he said, smiling at her. She threw her head back and gazed him straight in the eyes. "That's going to be my future job."
"To look splendid?"
"Yes."
"And wear a crown?"
"And wear a crown." They continued to consider each other without speaking. Nick's heart contracted with pity and perplexity.
"Oh, Coral, it's not decided?"
She scrutinized him for a last penetrating moment, then she looked away. "I'm never long deciding." He hesitated, choking with contradictory impulses, and afraid to formulate any, lest they should either mislead or pain her. "Why didn't you tell me?" he questioned lamely, and instantly perceived his blunder. She sat down, and looked up at him under brooding lashes. Had he ever noticed the thickness of her lashes before? "Would it have made any difference, if I had told you?"
"Any difference? Sit down by me," she commanded.
"Want to talk to you. You can say now, whatever you might have said sooner.
I'm not married yet. I'm still free."
"You haven't given your answer?"
"It doesn't matter if I have."
The retort frightened him with a glimpse of what she still expected of him, and what he was still so unable to give.
"That means you've said yes?" he pursued, to buy in time.
"Yes or no, it doesn't matter. I had to say something. What I want is your advice."
"At the 11th hour? Or the 12th?
She paused. "How shall I do?" she questioned, with a sudden accent of helplessness. He looked at her as helplessly. He could not say, "Ask yourself, ask your parents." Her next word would sweep away such frail hypocrisies. Her "how shall I do?" meant "how are you going to do?" And he knew it, and knew that she knew it. "I'm a bad person to give anyone matrimonial advice," he began, with a strained smile, "but I had such a different vision for you."
"What kind of a vision?"
She was merciless. "Merely what people call happiness, dear. People call you see you don't believe in it yourself."
"Well, neither do I in that form, at any rate."
He considered.
I believe in trying for it, even if the trying's the best of it. Well, I've tried, and failed. And I'm 22, and I never was young. I suppose I haven't enough imagination. She drew a deep breath. Oh, I want something different. She appeared to search for the word. Want to be prominent, she declared.
Prominent?
She reddened swarthily. H, you smile, you think it's ridiculous. It doesn't seem worthwhile to you. That's because you've always had all those things. But I haven't. I know what father pushed up from, and I want to push up as high again higher. No, I haven't got much imagination. I've always liked facts. And I find I shall like the fact of being a princess choosing the people I associate with, and being up above all these European grandees that father and mother bow down to, though they think they despise them. You can be up above these people by just being yourself. You know how. But I need a platform, a skyscraper. Father and mother slaved to give me my education. They thought education was the important thing. But, since we've all three of us got mediocre minds, it has just landed us among mediocre people. Don't you suppose I see through all the sham science and sham art and sham everything we're surrounded with? That's why I want to buy a place at the very top, where I shall be powerful enough to get about me the people I want, the big people, the right people, and to help them, I want to promote culture, like those Renaissance women you're always talking about. I want to do it for Apex City, do you understand? And for father and mother too. I want all those titles carved on my tombstone. They're facts, anyhow. Don't laugh at me. Dot dot dot. She broke off with one of her clumsy smiles, and moved away from him to the other end of the room. He sat looking at her with a curious feeling of admiration. Her harsh positivism was like a tonic to his disenchanted mood, and he thought, had a pity. Aloud he said, don't feel like laughing at you. You're a great woman. Then I shall be a great princess. Oh, but you might have been something so much greater. Her face flamed again. Aunt, say that. He stood up involuntarily, and drew near her. Why not? Because you're the only man with whom I can imagine the other kind of greatness. It moved him unexpectedly. He got as far as saying to himself, oh God, if she were not so hideously rich, and then of yielding for a moment to the persuasive vision of all that he and she might do with those very riches which he dreaded. After all, there was nothing mean in her ideals. They were hard and material, in keeping with her primitive and massive person, but they had a certain grim nobility. And when she spoke of the other kind of greatness, he knew that she understood what she was talking of, and was not merely saying something to draw him on, to get him to commit himself. There was not a drop of guile in her, except that which her very honesty distilled. The other kind of greatness? He repeated. Well, isn't that what you said happiness was? I wanted to be happy. Dot dot dot, but one can't choose. He went up to her. Oh, one can't choose. And how can anyone give you happiness who hasn't got it himself? He took her hands, feeling how large, muscular and voluntary they were, even as they melted in his palms. My poor Coral, of what use can I ever be to you? What you need is to be loved. She drew back, and gave him one of her straight strong glances. No, she said gallantly, but just to love. Part 3, XXV, in the persistent drizzle of a Paris winter morning, Susie Lansing walked back alone from the school at which S.E. had just deposited the four eldest Fulmers to the little house in Passy where, for the last 2 months, S.E. had been living with them. S.E. had on ready-made boots, an old waterproof and a last year's hat, but none of these facts disturbed her, though she took no particular pride in them. The truth was that she was too busy to think much about them. Since S.E. had assumed the charge of the Fulmer children, in the absence of both their parents in Italy, S.E. had had to pass through such an arduous apprenticeship of motherhood, that every moment of her waking hours was packed with things to do at once, and other things to remember to do later. There were only 5 Fulmers, but at times they were like an army with banners, and their power of self-multiplication was equaled only by the manner in which they could dwindle, vanish, grow mute, and become as it were a single tumbled brown head bent over a book in some corner of the house in which nobody would ever have thought of hunting for them, and which, of course, were at the bonds room in the attic, or the subterranean closet, where the trunks were kept, had been singled out by them for that very reason. These changes from ubiquity to invisibility would have seemed to Susie, a few months earlier, one of the most maddening of many characteristics not calculated to promote repose. But now she felt differently. As he had grown interested in her charges, and the search for a clue to their methods, whether tribal or individual, was as exciting to her as the development of a detective story. What interested her most in the whole stirring business was the discovery that they had a method. These little creatures, pitched upward into experience on the tossing waves of their parents' agitated lives, had managed to establish a rough and ready system of self-government. Junie, the eldest, the one who already chose her mother's hats and tried to put order in her wardrobe, was the recognized head of the state. At 12 she knew lots of things which her mother had never thoroughly learned, and Susie, her temporary mother, had never even guessed at. She spoke with authority on all vital subjects, from castor oil to flannel underclothes, from the fair sharing of stamps or marbles to the number of helpings of rice pudding or jam which each child was entitled to. There was hardly any appeal from her verdict. Yet each of her subjects revolved in his or her own orbit of independence, according to laws which Junie acknowledged and respected. And the interpreting of this mysterious charter of rights and privileges had not been without difficulty for Susie. Besides this, there were material difficulties to deal with. The 6 of them, and the breathless Bon who cooked and slaved for them all, had but a slim budget to live on. And, as Junie remarked, you'd have thought the boys ate their shoes, the way they vanished. They ate, certainly, a great deal else, and mostly of a nourishing and expensive kind. They had definite views about the amount and quality of their food, and were capable of concerted rebellion when Susie's catering fell beneath their standard. All this made her life a hurried and harassing business, but never what as he had most feared it would be a dull or depressing one. It was not, she owned to herself, that the society of the Fulmer children had roused in her any abstract passion for the human young. She knew had known since Nick's first kiss, how she would love any child of his and hers, and as he had cherished poor little Clarissa Vanderlyn with a shrinking and wistful solicitude. But in these rough young Fulmers she took a positive delight, and for reasons that were increasingly clear to her. It was because, in the first place, they were all intelligent, and because their intelligence had been fed only on things worth caring for. However inadequate Grace Fulmer's bringing up of her increasing tribe had been, they had heard in her company nothing trivial or dull. Good music, good books and good talk had been their daily food, and if at times they stamped, and roared and crashed about like children unblessed by such privileges, at others they shone with the light of poetry, and spoke with the voice of wisdom. That had been Susie's discovery. For the first time she was among awakening minds which had been wakened only to beauty. Greater than from their cramped and uncomfortable household, Grace and Nat Fulmer had managed to keep out mean envies, vulgar admirations, shabby discontents. Above all the din and confusion the great images of beauty had brooded, like those ancestral figures that stood apart on their shelf in the poorest Roman households. No, the task as he had undertaken for want of a better, gave Susie no sense of a missed vocation. Othering on a large scale would never, she perceived, be her job. Rather it gave her, in odd ways, the sense of being herself mothered, of taking her first steps in the life of immaterial values which had begun to... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.